From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said today that White House lawyers will respond to a request for documents belonging to more than 80 people, including the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., and the Trump Organization's chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg. The request is from Gerald Nadler, the Democratic chair of the House Judiciary Committee, who says he believes President Trump obstructed justice. Also today, former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper announced his entry into the 2020 Democratic race. And over the weekend, the Republican Rand Paul says he'll join three other Republican senators and vote to block President Trump's emergency declaration, which would end-run Congress and use other funds to build a wall. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here to start the week. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
Rand Paul first. He joins Susan Collins, Tom Tillis, Lisa Murkowski, who say they'll join Democrats in voting to block Trump's emergency declaration. Because what? Paul said he couldn't be against Obama doing this and not Trump?
Well, he said that he's against a president getting, quote, extra constitutional powers. So he doesn't want, someone like a Democrat to come in and be able to, you know, declare a national emergency, set a kind of precedent where they declare a national emergency, let's say, for climate change or gun violence. And there are a lot of Republicans who do feel that way as well.
Yeah. Well, to override the presidential veto, though, the Senate will need many more votes, a two-thirds majority. They don't have that now. And Trump has said he will use that veto for the first time in his presidency. Here he is speaking to reporters in the Oval Office recently.
Will I veto it? 100%. 100%. And I don't think it survives a veto. We have too many smart people that want border security, so I can't imagine it could survive a veto. But I will veto it, yes.
Of course, Democrats say that's not what it's about. They just don't think the wall offers border security. But what about Republicans? You know, we're hearing even if they do question it, which many don't, they may worry about being primaried, you know, Trump supporters running against them. So is this vote, this move by these four Republicans, does it mean anything?
Well, I don't think it indicates a broader shift away from the president necessarily. I think, in fact, if you look at polling and then also talk to Republicans, they will say that they had some misgivings about him using a national emergency again because of the precedent it could set for a Democratic president potentially in the future. Even, in fact, when I was at CPAC last week, the Conservative Political Action Conference, I did ask people in the hallways about what they thought of the president. There was very little dissension. They really are very much behind this president and his reelection. But the one area where they maybe had a little bit of a misgiving was on the national emergency declaration, although then they blamed Democrats for not being on board. So I think Republicans in the Senate, at least a handful of them, feel like they have at least some wiggle room here to be able to oppose the president on a national emergency, to stand on that on principle and not have to worry about political blowback.
Well, we'll see what happens there. But on to 2020, former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper announcing his candidacy for the Democratic nomination, so we get to say Hickenlooper a lot. Let's listen.
I'm running for president because we need dreamers in Washington, but we also need to get things done. I've proven again and again I can bring people together to produce the progressive change Washington has failed to deliver. Join me, and we'll repair the damage done to our country and be stronger than ever.
So, Domenico, Hickenlooper, the second governor or former governor to enter the race, now 16 total candidates. Most of them are not older white men, as he is. And polls show Democrats want diversity. So he's selling himself there as, you know, someone who's brought together Republicans and Democrats. But who is he appealing to?
Well, you know, there haven't been a lot of Democratic governors, frankly, in a lot of states that are purple-like states. And, you know, Colorado, even though it's gone for a Democrat in the last couple of presidential elections, last few, it has been a state that had been more Republican-leaning or with lots of independents. So he is somebody who's trying to make a case, a Western governor who has been a two-term governor, who knows how to legislate, has gotten a lot done across the aisle, healthcare expansion, for example, gun restrictions. Mm-hmm. He's very much in favor of environmental regulations that he worked with industry on and environmentalists. Now, whether or not the Democratic Party base is going to be in favor of that kind of pragmatic candidate, that's something that he's going to certainly test out. You know, right. Colorado is known, obviously, as the first state in the country to legalize marijuana, but Hickenlooper was somebody who actually opposed that expansion and then kind of reluctantly got on board as a champion to say that the state has done a fairly good job rolling it out.
Look, Domenico, you mentioned the CPAC, Conservative Political Action Conference. The president spoke there, 2-hour-long address. Some people said he seemed off the rails. He used the crude word beginning with bull to describe the Mueller investigation. But his recent poll, there's one poll out today that shows that, you know, his personal rating ticked up a bit. What do you make of all this briefly?
You know, that speech was every Trump grievance ever heard in a 2-hour speech, maybe the longest address a president has ever given, but his base firmly behind him. And that's where he's heading into 2020, certainly shaping up for another close election.
NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Well, in Alabama, rescue workers are searching for survivors of the devastating tornadoes that tore through the southeast yesterday. At least 23 people are confirmed dead in Lee County, Alabama, and the number of missing people remains in the double digits. At a press conference this morning, Lee County Sheriff Jay Jones said that children as young as 6 are among the dead, and the damage to homes and infrastructure is catastrophic.
It looks almost as if someone took a giant knife and just scrape the ground. There are slabs where homes formerly stood. There are debris everywhere. Trees are snapped. Whole forested areas are just, the trees are just snapped and lying on the ground.
Joining us now from Beauregard, Alabama, is Miranda Fulmore, reporter with WBHM. Miranda, you're in Lee County, the hardest hit part of Alabama. What kind of damage have you seen today?
Yeah, so I've seen a lot of downed trees, a lot of trees on houses, big chunks of wood. People are currently out in the field doing search and rescue, but also cleanup. They have a lot of chainsaws out, but there's trees and debris everywhere, a lot of closed roads. This is a really rural community, so there's a lot of trees around, a lot of cleanup to do.
And this is an area, you're between Auburn in Alabama and Columbus in Georgia, but as you say, a very rural community. How much warning was there for these tornadoes?
You know, there was a good amount, or there was a good amount of warning. They started warning on Friday, the National Weather Service did, about possible severe weather and tornadoes. And I know when people typically think of Tornado Valley, they think of, you know, the West, but Alabama has their own version of Tornado Alley. And so people usually take it very seriously here, but at the same time, this is a really rural community, so, you know, they don't necessarily have the means to leave or want to leave. So there was warning from the National Weather Service, but when it came on Sunday, it came Sunday afternoon, right after church. A lot of people had just gotten home, so they had to get to their safe place quickly.
And, you know, I grew up in Tornado Alley, sort of, in Illinois, in central Illinois. 23 people dead in a day is pretty significant. Are people just in shock there?
It is pretty significant. We haven't seen a lot of this in Alabama since 2011. I will say the sheriff, Jay Jones, was talking about how in his whole experience here in Lee County, he's never seen anything like it. He said even in 50 years, he's never seen anything like this. There's a whole stretch of a street where just people, their homes were destroyed, and unfortunately, they died as well. So this is, it's a challenging time for this town of 8,000 to 10,000 people.
What kind of effort is underway right now to find more survivors?
So there are about 200 law enforcement and emergency management search crews out and about. They're using canine units to help detect people. And then they're also using heat detection drones to help detect heat in specific areas to hopefully locate people that may be under rubble and not easily identified. So those search crews are out and about right now. But Sheriff Jones says he isn't surprised if the death toll rises, because as of right now, the missing people, the amount of missing people is in the double digits still.
And the Alabama governor, Kay Ivey, declared a state of emergency last night. President Trump tweeted this morning that he's working closely with the governor and with FEMA to give the state, quote, A-plus treatment in responding to the tornadoes. Are local officials feeling like they're getting the help that they need?
According to Sheriff Jones, he feels that way. There's a lot of local law enforcement here. There's actually only about around 80 law enforcement here, but they have 200 total. So people, law enforcement from other communities, surrounding counties, but also surrounding states. They're right at, Lee County is right on the edge of Georgia and Alabama's borderline. So some law enforcement from Georgia has come over as well to help with search efforts and cleanup.
That is WBHM's Miranda Fulmore joining us from Lee County in Alabama, which was devastated by yesterday's tornadoes. Miranda, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And the tornadoes that touched down there were part of a larger weather system that spawned tornadoes in other parts of Alabama, as well as Georgia and the Florida Panhandle yesterday. It also brought heavy snow to parts of the Northeast and dangerously cold temperatures to the upper Midwest.
A personal note. My mom was a cloth coat person until very late in life, when she picked up a used fur jacket at the resale store she founded and ran, a personal triumph for her, and I wish I'd been kinder. But like PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, I'm concerned about fur's cruelty to animals. Well, so is Jasmine Sanders, but in a recent piece in the New York Times, she explored the history of fur, including her own African-American mothers, whose furs, Jasmine wrote, were her insistence on public elegance in a world frequently inhospitable to her. Well, that brought to mind another moment when I worked for an almost exclusively African-American TV staff that wanted to do a fur fashion show. I felt I couldn't, and one young woman said to me, "Oh, now that my people can finally afford a fur, you're telling me it's not cool?" Let's bring in writer Jasmine Sanders. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And, you know, when I read your article, I was reminded of that moment, and it's something you've heard a lot.
Yes, I have. It's an image that I think has become almost archetypical, right? A black woman on her way somewhere wrapped up in this big, sumptuous fur.
And as you write, for women like your mother, your grandmother, your aunts, your sisters, it was more than a personal luxury item. This was an investment.
Yes. My grandmother died when I was pretty young. I'd never seen her in a fur coat. But I remember my mother telling me, you know, we would go down south and those family members had houses, and we never had a house, but my mother had other things. You know, she had fur, and that was something that my mother said that really stuck with me, the importance that the coat came to hold.
Well, and let's just be clear, your grandmother never had a house because she, in the Great Migration, went to Chicago, where federal housing codes barred loans being offered to black people. There was all sorts of housing discrimination. She couldn't have a house.
Right.
Right. Well, talk more about your mother.
Yeah, so my mother's first coat was a mink. She and my aunts would say, you know, when you're over 35 as a woman, you have to have a mink. It's like a really elegant status item when you're older. So when she was in her 40s, she bought her mink, and she got it for herself from a furrier in Chicago that's really well known, called Andriana Furs. And then her second fur coat, which is a fox fur, was a gift from her husband just like a few years ago.
And the first coat, she was at that moment single and, as you write, employed at the same drug rehab center that she credited with her own sobriety. This was something that she had to save a lot for. Do with an installment plan on layaway.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it was a celebration of her sobriety and also being a woman who was in her 40s and single and kind of feeling good about herself. So she wanted to purchase a big item.
So there's the thinking, which ran right into a cultural shift. And many black women feel that this sort of cultural disavowal of fur suspiciously coincides with their ability to get it.
Yeah, it was similar to something that my mom had said when I was interviewing her about PETA. And she said, "I don't feel like that has anything to do with me. We live on the south side of Chicago. I don't see those people here. They don't seem to want to be speaking to me anyway. And so I feel like we're operating kind of completely outside of that." And so I remember thinking about that kind of cultural disconnect between what mainstream culture is doing versus what women like my mother and like black women in general are doing in fashion and style. And so I was reading books about how black women approach style, and I came across a quote by Paula Marie Seniors where she says of her mother, "The tide is always turning. You know, like the minute black women could afford to get a fur coat, white society said that fur wasn't okay." So it was kind of hearing that from my mother and then finding evidence of other people who felt that way.
Do you think there's, it is more than a coincidence? Do you think, I mean, that one has anything to do with the other?
I think that it's, I don't know that it's directly connected, but I do think it's indicative of the mainstream animal rights movement not knowing how to engage Black people. And it feels like Black people, especially Black women, are a huge blind spot, and they seem to not understand it.
Well, you quote a letter from the then head of PETA that was reportedly written to Aretha Franklin. And saying what?
Aretha Franklin, basically for her entire career, was a noted fur collector. And the president of PETA at the time wrote her this really nasty letter where he insulted her size. He told her she looked like a clown. And, you know, her fur coats made her look old, and like an unimaginable letter to Aretha Franklin. And she never officially responded, but I guess her response was in her continuing to wear her fur coats.
It seems like what you were saying is, boy, if you ever wanted to have somebody you could maybe talk to and bring in as a partner in your campaign against the treatment of animals, you really lost that moment with Aretha there. I mean, you know, that was not going to happen. Right. In your writing, you also take us through the history of fur, which is very closely tied to the history of America. The expansion of the country had to do with trapping and hunting beavers. Marian Anderson stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, sang in a fur after she wasn't allowed to sing at Constitution Hall. So it's just really, really entwined. How was this also about you trying to decide how you feel about fur?
It was, absolutely. For example, I spoke to a PETA spokesperson, and he began the interview with asking, you know, Jasmine, how do you feel about fur? And I explained to him that I was kind of fur ambiguous. Like, I can't imagine purchasing one, but I'm so wrapped by the image of my mother wearing her furs and other Black women wearing their furs. And I have like any number of pictures on the internet of myself in my mother's fur coat, which he mentioned. Like, well, we've seen the pictures online of you in fur, so we were just wondering your feelings about it. But obviously, I recognize the importance of conservation and veganism and being mindful of consumption and the things that we are consuming. So I would say I am fur ambiguous.
Except when it might come to your mom, who doesn't sound like she's leaving us very soon. But
no.
leaving you her fur.
Yeah. Again, I can't. And even as recently as this interview, when my mother asked me, do I want a fur? And I was just kind of unsure. You know, I don't know that I would be able to wear it. But again, it's just an image that I'm really enamored with and that I'm really charmed by. And I feel like there should be room for people to say, I mean, I consider myself like attempting to be at least a mindful consumer. So I feel like there should be room for people who kind of aren't so sure.
Or people who want to wrap themselves in the thing that may even still smell of their mother.
And, yeah, absolutely. PETA, a lot of the times, will advocate for people to donate their fur coats if they're newly vegan to homeless shelters where they'll make like fur blankets out of them, which is a nice gesture, but it's like it doesn't mean that the animal didn't die for it already. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, there's kind of no unskinning the animal or the mink.
You you close with a pretty enduring image of your mom at a cousin's funeral in her fur.
Yeah, I think part of what's lost with like modern documentation of street style is like women like that are lost. Black women you see going to church or going wherever they're going in the wintertime with their big fur coats on, like my mom. It's kind of an image you don't see in publications anymore, but you're familiar with it and you see it when you walk down the street. Like, I live next door to a church now, and I love seeing so many Black women come to church in their mink. So I do think it's a totem of like Black urban life
and resilience.
Yeah.
By the way, what's been the response to your article?
It's been overwhelmingly positive, which shocked me a little bit.
With people saying what?
People saying that it's something that they'd always felt and always thought about, that they had this image in their mind or this image that they were familiar with, which was a Black woman in a mink.
That's the history. But what do you make of young African-Americans wearing fur today? Tiffany Haddish protesting what she says is police brutality against African Americans by continuing to wear fur? I'm guessing, kind of saying, well, maybe people first before animals. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Big Boy or fur coat to the Super Bowl?
Big Boy. Cardi, really serendipitous. The day that the article came out, Cardi showed up to her court hearing and it was beautiful, like fox fur, I believe it was. I think the message is a kind of defiance. I think that most Black people, especially Black celebrities, are aware of the current climate and the power that PETA may hold. And so I think that choosing to go out publicly in fur is definitely, I think, a potent statement regarding what you're not willing to give up and the ways that you won't allow yourself to be redirected or to be limited by the whims of mainstream fashion.
Well, and we should say that PETA made what many people thought were really bad steps when they had a campaign that juxtaposed a picture of a Black civil rights protester being beaten at a lunch counter with images of a seal being bludgeoned, both horrific, but the idea of human-animal comparison was, you tell me, seemed insulting.
It is. It's incredibly insulting. And there's also, if you're a Black person, you know that your body and your personage are often compared to animals and often considered animalistic and of no more value than an animal.
So I want to be clear, Jasmine, and I'm going to let you go. It all seemed to be working towards really one thing, a lot of work, towards one thing, which a lot of people will be familiar with, whether or not you will take your mom's furs. And you've concluded, you concluded what?
I've concluded that I will. I won't buy one, but I'll definitely take them.
Jasmine Sanders, her piece is A Black Legacy Wrapped Up in Fur. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Jasmine, thanks so much for the talk. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So, lots here, including, is a hand-me-down just different or still a symbol of cruelty to animals? Thoughts, welcome, hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And let's take a look now at where we are in the economy. It enjoyed a surge in growth of 4.2% in the second quarter of last year. Can you say tax cuts? So the question was, would that growth continue in the first quarter of 2019? And here to answer that question is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Jill, welcome.
Thank you.
And you seem to, in past conversations, suspect the answer to this question. What is it?
Yes, and the answer is that 4.2% print that we had in the second quarter of last year was the high watermark for growth. We saw a slip in the third quarter, and then just last week, the government released the fourth quarter number, even lower. So look at all of 2018. We got 2.9% annualized growth. And again, that's a good number. It's the best since 2015. It is the high end of the range for the whole recovery, but it is not the promised 3% plus that the tax cuts were supposed to deliver. And now in the first quarter of this year, things are kind of slumping, and part of that is the government shutdown, but it's also that the impact of those tax cuts, it's starting to wane. And so when we look forward from not just this first quarter, we'll probably be at 1%. We're looking for the whole year, maybe around 2.5% growth for 2019.
But as you remind us, there can be some good news here because too much growth is sometimes a problem, and so this can have a good side.
Yes, this is what I call the bizarro land of investing and economics coming together, right? Because last year we had strong growth and the stock market fell over the course of the year. This year we're having slower growth and the stock market is up in the first couple of months of the year. So what gives? Well, remember, the stock market is a forward-looking indicator, meaning that last year a lot of investors started to get freaked out that the Federal Reserve was going to raise interest rates kind of as far as the eye could see.
Because the economy was heating up too much and they were worried about inflation?
That's exactly right. So that was the big concern last year. Now, this year, growth is moderating. The Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell testified before Congress last week, kind of said, like, we're sitting on our hands right now. And so that's very good news for investors. Add to that that it looks like the U.S.-China trade negotiations are going to lead to something. And now we have a more moderate growth rate, but investors are feeling more comfortable because they say, okay, if interest rates stay at these levels, we can live with that. Companies can make money.
And what about jobs? The Labor Department will, of course, release the jobs report for the month of February on Friday. What's the sense there?
Well, you know, January was a huge number. We got 304,000 new jobs in January. So we'll see whether the revision holds that. But here in February, what it looks like is we'll get more around the 190,000, maybe 200,000 jobs for the month. The unemployment rate, which moved around last month because of those furloughed government workers, that should drop back to where it was, 3.8, 3.9%. And maybe the most important component to anyone listening who has a job, wages are expected to rise by 3.2% from a year ago. That's really good news because with inflation pretty low, 3.2% can put some extra money in your bottom line.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money, and author of The Dumb Things Smart People Do with Their Money. We've got an interview with her on that book at hearnow.org. Check that out as well. Jill, thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
Okay, let's take a break from the news now for a hip-hop edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. I got loyalty, inside my DNA. I got a rapper turned trapper can morph into us, but a trapper turned rapper can morph into Puff. Yeah, my butt been on the pedal. Yeah. I've been on this level. Yeah, when I marry Keisha, only time I'm gonna settle. Yeah. They call me Cardi, Cardi, banging body, spicy mommy, hot tamale, hotter than a Somali, bird, go, Fresh is a DJ at KUTX in Austin, Texas. He co-hosts a hip-hop show every Saturday night called The Breaks. And Fresh, that's just your name, right? We're just calling you Fresh today.
Yes, it's just Fresh.
Okay, good. And you're going to be introducing us to the Austin hip-hop scene. How big is it? What is the scene in Austin right now?
The word that I and my co-host Confucius, who unfortunately couldn't be here with me today, the word we like to use is growing. It's not as big or as known or as massive as, say, Houston's or Dallas's here in Texas. But there are some people here gaining a lot of traction and a lot of good traction from many national outlets and within the massive hip hop community outside of the state of Texas.
But would you say that a lot of them are still considered underground hip hop artists?
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's listen to some of the ones that you have brought us today. And we should note that not everything we're going to hear is going to be maybe suitable for younger listeners. However, we will bleep out anything that we have to bleep out. The first one is called Mrs. Mrs. It's by Harry Idokwa. Hey, Mrs. Mrs., I must have followed. Just Mrs. Mrs., I can't forget ya. I must have missed ya. Hey, Mrs. Mrs., I won't release ya. I can't forget her. Hey, Mrs. Mrs. It's been 6 months and some digits. It's been 6 months and some extra. When will I finesse your love? Take you by the neck, whisper naked thoughts and nakedness. I learned my lesson. Tell us about this one.
Harry is a transplant here in the city of Austin. He originally is from McKinley, Texas, out in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He said he moved down here simply to make music, and he heard about Austin's ever-growing music scene. And as you hear, he's not your traditional sounding rap artist.
Right.
Some people probably would categorize him as R&B. Others have said rock and roll. I think Harry as an artist and that song as a whole really shows you how expansive and immersive hip-hop is and how hip-hop pulls from all of these different genres, jazz, blues, rock, R&B, soul, funk.
Well, and actually, just to that point, this is something that he has said to describe his music. He says it's like a house. The master bedroom is reggae. The guest rooms are hip-hop and R&B. The beat is like the ice cream man jingle. Creating a track is like opening the front door. Whichever kids run out are the influences on the track.
Yeah, I mean, basically, that's a great way to describe, right. I mean, hip-hop and Harry. Like, it definitely captures your attention.
Okay, the next one is called Drive. This is by DZ Brown, and the subject matter, again, a little intense. Here we go again and again. I can see her soul through her skin. She's trying to hide every mistake. Black eyes on the Cartier lens.
White beater, now she leaving again. Now she back to mixing weed with the gin. Looking for a good reason to sin. Take my hand, let's leave in the Benz.
Definitely a Kanye sound in this one.
Exactly. That is exactly how I was going to lead in with that one. DZ is very, very influenced by Kanye West. You can go as far as saying he's a child of Kanye West. I and DZ are in the generation where we kind of grew up or age to Kanye's music, though. College Dropout, Late Registration, Graduation, all of those albums. He's a very transformative artist, and his music kind of reflects that. Whatever he's really feeling or whatever he's really inspired by at the time is going to reflect, be reflected within the music. At the time he was making that album Judith, which the song Drive is on, Kanye kind of was like up there. He was before his, as I would say, his fall from grace. Kanye still was the figure, the go-to guy when it came to pushing the genre of hip-hop.
What do you think of Kanye now, by the way?
Oh, man, so many thoughts, so little time. Okay. I'll just say he's having a bit of a fall from grace. Right.
Okay, the next one that you brought us is called Gray Area. This is by The Tito.
Lately I've been fighting with you. I'm fine with myself. Like, what should I do? This life is a movie, baby. I'll shoot it with you. This life is like music, baby. I want to sing it with you. Lately I've been fighting with you. I'm with myself, like what should I do? This life is a movie, baby, I shoot it with you. This life is like music, baby, I wanna sing it with you. I move to my own drum, if you give me a good thing, I'm yeah. I might give you my love, but you can't give it up. I was finding myself, I ain't know who to trust.
I like this one, and I see that he has called this music New Age Pretty Boy Trap.
Yes, that is a phrase he coined himself maybe about 2 or 3 years ago, and nobody has bucked against it, so it's sticking and it's working. The Tita is an artist who wears his heart on his sleeves. If he loves you, he loves you. If he doesn't like you, he doesn't like you. If he hates you, he hates you. And it comes out in his music, as you just heard with Gray Area. A lot of his music comes from personal experience and him just living his everyday life, and what a life he leads.
What do you mean by that?
If you would see Tito walking around or see him perform, you would get the sense that he is a rock star. And he does live his life with the rock star experience.
Okay, well, the next one that you brought us is the first female artist on your list. This is Naomi Sutton with What You Need.
You choose your fate. Caught up in the game with me, with me, with me, with me. Rock-a-bye, baby. Rock-a-bye, baby. Will I be your lady? Jada to Will, maybe one day. I'm trying to be your Gina, Alicia, Katia. We still bumping 90s R&B. I get so weak in the knees. Living in a different era.
A lot of references there to people that used to listen to in the 90s. Tell us why you picked this one.
Naomi is a very budding and emerging artist here in Austin, R&B wise, and she's got a lot of talent and a lot of growth. And a song like What You Need, I think most women today can relate to that, talking to someone that they're either trying to be in a relationship with or currently in a relationship with. And just asking them, basically, yo, what is it for me that you need? Mm-hmm. You tell me what you need, and then we can move from there.
Are there a lot of women in the Austin hip-hop scene?
No. It's very limited when it comes to women, but the women that are a part of the scene, you know them, and you know them well, and they have a huge fan base.
Okay, the last one that we have time for today is called Daily Interlude. This is by Jake Lloyd.
Woke up this morning, hating myself, hated the way I looked, the way I thought and the way I felt. The cards on the table were poorly dealt. Then the world starts to beat on me with karma's belt. But by the time the clock struck five,
And I feel great. And I feel great.
What a great voice and a very different sound than the others.
Yes, that is Jake in a nutshell. Most people here in Austin know the voice, and they love to see him perform. Like Harry, he's an artist that pulls from every different genre to incorporate it all into his music. Most people would classify him as an R&B artist, but some have said alt-rock, some have said blues.
Right.
And I think you get that, like you said, his voice, you can hear the soul, you can hear the blues, you can hear the rock and roll influences.
He's more Leon Bridges than Kanye, for sure.
Definitely.
All right, well, some great picks from you. Really interesting. Another great reason to go to Austin, Texas and check out the music scene. Fresh, who hosts the Saturday night hip-hop show called The Breaks, along with, did you say Confucius?
Yes, Confucius.
Okay,
Jones.
Well, thank you for joining us, and really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. That's NPR Here and Now on Spotify. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
A new study published in the journal JAMA Network Open confirms what many are already feeling. Death rates from opioids skyrocketed in the U.S. from 1999 to 2016, increasing more than fourfold, with the eastern half of the country hit hardest, including Ohio. And in all states, the consequences of the opioid crisis go beyond public health. Judges in Ohio say their courtrooms are jammed with misdemeanor cases tied to addiction, but they're hoping a new treatment clinic in an unlikely location will help cut that caseload. Paige Flager of member station WOSU reports.
It's a busy morning in the Franklin County Courthouse. People stream through metal detectors and elbow their way into elevators.
You have to be aggressive.
Jessica Gerwin presses the button for the sixth floor.
Floor 6, going down. And so when you get up here, you make a right.
She steps into a courtroom, walks past the rows of chairs and the judge's bench, and opens a door, revealing a makeshift health clinic. A table is lined with boxes of rubber gloves, needles, and Vivitrol, the drug that blocks opioid receptors in the brain for a month at a time to help prevent relapse.
This was actually the judge's robing room, and the judges were basically like, we don't need a room to put robes on. Let's utilize this space to help people.
Gerwin works for Positive Recovery Solutions, the company that set up the clinic last year. It's part of a trend, bringing treatment closer to the criminal justice system. More than 3,000 special drug courts offer treatment as an alternative to a cell. And some courthouses now welcome programs like group counseling sessions. But having a clinic in the courthouse is unusual. Gerwin says it takes a lot of buy-in to set up a program like this. And that starts a few floors up in the courtroom.
If you do have a drug and alcohol problem, you will be back. And then we will have more problems to deal with. So,
Judge Eileen Paley says most of the crimes she handles, from solicitation to stealing, are tied to addiction.
People aren't stealing out of greed. They're stealing out of need. I mean, there's a desperate need for their next fix. I've actually had people using heroin in the bathroom and then coming into my court.
A few doors down, Judge James O'Grady says, depending on prior arrests, he is more than willing to cut a deal with someone who goes to the clinic.
So if somebody expresses an interest in getting treatment, then I take the jail days off the table. I'm certainly not going to send someone to jail at that point, because I realize that just putting someone in jail is not going to help anyone with an addiction problem.
For someone in jail, the clinic program can be part of a release plan. That's what Judge O'Grady offered Corey, a former heroin user. Dressed in a tan uniform, he's handcuffed to a pipe in the wall and swiveling anxiously on a chair as he talks to social worker Catherine Richards from the probation department.
I'm about to have a child. She's 6 months pregnant. She's going to doctor's appointments on her own, mm-hmm. all this. Like, mm-hmm. So really, that's my main issue. Like, how long does it take to get it?
Okay. I mean, how soon can you get out of jail?
Richard says she fields questions like Corey's all the time.
It's always a concern that when their primary motivation seems to be getting out of jail. But for people who are in jail, that's just normal.
She says even though Corey might use the clinic program as a quicker way out of jail, it could get him thinking more about treatment. Nate, who's on probation, also asked us not to use his last name because he doesn't want potential employers to know he's in recovery. This is his third time at the courthouse clinic.
I mean, it's just misdemeanor probation, but I'm doing better now. So I got this program to thank for that.
Nurse Katie Gast greets him like they're old friends. They talk about Game of Thrones and group meetings.
Your right side today. Are you excited?
No.
Come on.
Outside, Nate's mom is waiting. She says last year, when he overdosed, she thought she had lost her son.
When you're the actual parent to one of these kids that's killing themselves, it's heartbreaking.
Since it opened in July, nearly 100 people have gotten shots of Vivitrol at the Franklin County Courthouse Clinic, and about 66% of them are meeting all the terms of their probation. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager in Columbus, Ohio.
And we have some sad news to report from Hollywood today. Actor Luke Perry has died after suffering a massive stroke last week at his home in Sherman Oaks, California. He shot to fame in the 1990s with his long-running role in the teenage drama Beverly Hills 90210, playing the mysterious, brooding heartthrob Dylan McKay in love with Shannon Doherty's character Brenda Walsh.
You're going to spend 3 days in Palm Springs with Kelly and Donna.
What's wrong with that?
How about I get us a room?
Where?
In Palm Springs. Kelly and Donna can drop you off at the hotel, and you can tell your parents you're staying with them, and then we'll have 3 whole days to spend together.
I don't know.
Yes, you do.
Perry also had roles on the TV show Oz and more recently on CW's hit show Riverdale. But 90210 was a cultural touchstone for people of a certain age, and Perry's co-star, Ian Ziering, responded to his friend's death saying he will forever bask in the loving memories they shared over the last 30 years. Lou Perry was just 52, but it's amazing, you know, to hear that because he's always going to be that image that we had from that show.
Right.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.